This is the session on polarisation, populism and the crisis of neoliberalism. My name is Simone and I am a long-term member of the branch here of Social Alternative in Sydney. And so I'd like to introduce Liz Walsh, who's going to introduce this topic, and after that we'll have some time to discuss it, to raise questions, to make contributions, debate things if people are so inclined. So I might just hand over her to get going. Liz has been a member of Socialist Alternative for a very long time, and she's the current campaign coordinator of the Victorian Socialists, a really exciting project happening in Victoria where Socialist Alternative has been involved in campaigning to elect a socialist to Parliament in Victoria. So I'll hand over to Liz.
Cool, thanks everyone. Okay, so the Western liberal capitalist order is in crisis, and there are many expressions of this crisis. There's the enduring instability in the global economy, the enduring fragility, even though it's stabilised since the 2008 crisis, but there's sort of underlying real problems there. There's Trump's defeat of Hillary Clinton and the sharp shift to the right in bourgeois politics in the US. The opening shots of a trade war between the US and China, the collapse of numerous social democratic parties, the rise of the far right in country after country. In a few places, there's been a political break to the left, though that's a minority of cases. So you might sort of think about some left-wing figures like the rise of Bernie Sanders in conflict with the establishment Democrats, although not that much conflict. There's also Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party in the UK, political parties like Podemos, Syriza, until they capitulated, and so on. And, of course, none of these expressions of the crisis of neoliberalism are exactly the same. They all have their own dynamics. Some are, you can say, for instance, Brexit and the argument to leave the European Union. There's a progressive case about that expression of the crisis in the UK, but there's no progressive argument that can be made to vote for Trump, for instance. But whatever the differences, they have a lot in common as well. And I think, to put it simply, the 40 years of neoliberalism and nearly 10 years of what the Marxist economist Michael Roberts has called the Long Depression has destabilised the political systems of advanced capitalist states. It's created volatility, it's created political polarisation, and it's also created an increasingly dangerous world. It's also created some openings and opportunities for the radical left as well. Okay, so what is neoliberalism? Firstly, I think it's important to understand that neoliberalism is a phase in global capitalism, that it's not just an ideology or a set of policies. Importantly, it was a ruling class response to the crisis that emerged in the system in the 1970s, and it was a way for the ruling class to deal with falling profits, with stagnation, as well as facing at the same time quite a strong labour movement. The neoliberal medicine was first administered in sort of the developing countries, so the West using the IMF, the WTO and so on, to impose structural adjustment programs on developing countries in the 70s, but the attacks really came to the core of the capitalist system in the 1980s. It's most associated with the hard right of bourgeois politics, so with Thatcher, Reagan, the Chilean dictator Pinochet, who were seen as sort of the vanguard pushing a certain line of attack for the capitalist class. So it's not like it just emerged fully formed and everyone's like, yeah, this is what we're going to do. It's sort of introduced in fits and starts at different tempo in different countries. In Australia, for instance, it was the Labor Party that was key to implementing the initial push towards neoliberal reforms under Hawke and then under Keating in terms of privatisation, deregulation of the labour market. And indeed, what really cemented neoliberalism's triumph and Thatcher's argument that there was no alternative to neoliberalism was Blair's embrace of neoliberalism, New Labour, or the Democrats' embrace of it under Bill Clinton. Okay, so on the economic front, neoliberalism involves things like slashing corporate taxes, floating national currencies on the stock market, wholesale privatisation of previously state-owned industries, the commodification of everything from water to education and so on. There was also the removal of tariffs that had once shielded local industries and opened it up to international market competition, something which really massively restructured industry. It was also accompanied with the explosion of foreign trade, the establishment of transnational supply chains, and the massive growth of foreign direct investment. Alongside globalisation and the rise of multinational corporate giants was also the centrality of finance capital, the relaxing of banking regulations, and the huge growth in speculation in financial markets. So all of this helped to create the neoliberal boom of the 1980s and 90s. But by the late 90s, things started to become unstuck, and this is when you start seeing the speculative bubbles really coming to the fore in terms of the dot-com boom, the housing boom, and when these when these blew up, it really exposed, I think, the underlying weaknesses of the global economy in terms of things like the lack of investment in production and so on. So at the heart of neoliberalism, I think it's important to understand it as class war, that it was about a full frontal attack on the working class, a ratcheting up of exploitation, an attack on their organisations, their trade unions. In this class war, the ruling class have been largely successful, I think. While corporate profits have boomed, working class living standards declined, wages stagnated or even fell, the rights at work and our unions have been decimated as bosses went on the offensive. So instead of having a more corporatist approach to managing labour relations, giving trade unions a seat at the table as part of trying to incorporate and neuter the trade union bureaucracy, but one particular method of managing the system, they move much more to the going on the offensive, lockouts, you know, refusing to bargain, introducing new laws that outlaw the right to strike, and so on. There's obviously pushback, but and in some countries, like France, for instance, the class struggle has been more successful at holding on to certain gains that workers made in the post-war period. But generally, there was a lot of defeat suffered. Another element of the neoliberal period is the ideological intervention by right-wing think tanks. So, the argument was that big government, with its large bureaucracies employing whole swathes of the population, delivering services, that had to go. Instead, everything had to be turned over to the market. Everything should be marketised. That this would produce a more efficient, more profitable and fairer society. That enriching the bankers and the corporate elite, that wealth would then eventually trickle down to the rest of us. Instead of government intervention, there would be self-correcting markets. Instead of collective identities, only the atomised individual expressing itself and fulfilling its needs through the vast sort of opportunities to consume on the market. All of this obviously lies. Not only has neoliberalism created immense inequality, greater than ever before, obviously the markets haven't self-corrected. We had the big crash of 2008. But we also haven't seen the retreat of the state either. That's, I think, a real myth of neoliberalism. That's just about multinational corporations. There's no such thing as really the state anymore. Actually, there was a real beefing up of the repressive apparatus of the state in this neoliberal period. So increased militarised policing, greater surveillance over the population, greater prison populations, more prisons and so on. In terms of globally, instead of bringing the world together in this sort of wonderful multicultural diversity, we have militarised borders. We have freedom of movement for the rich and powerful, for capital, but for the rest of us, razor wire, detention centres, impossible visas and so on. So real restrictions there. Okay, so that's neoliberalism in a nutshell. I now want to turn to the multifaceted crisis of neoliberalism. So first of all, on the economic front. After all, neoliberalism, fucking difficult word to say for me for some reason, was primarily a means to restore the profitability and the economic fortunes of the global capitalist class. And it did do that, as I explained. There was a boom period, but it all began to unravel in the late 90s. You start seeing the crisis ripping through peripheral economies like the Asian tigers. You have the collapse in Indonesia that leads to the massive student rebellion and the overthrow of Suharto. Also crisis ripping through Latin America. You had the run on the banks in Argentina. But it wasn't until really 2007, 2008 that the crisis really starts to grip the core of the global economy. And that's when you see the global financial crisis. That's when the American housing market collapses. You see lending seize up, world trade collapse, a huge disaster, really. The response of the ruling class was uniform across the world. So they threw out the neoliberal rulebook, which said everything had to be the market, no government intervention. Instead, massive state intervention to prop up its system. Huge printing of money, so quantitative easing. There's also, you know, the bailing out of the banks that had been the criminals that created much of the problems, their wild excesses in the first place. And so while there was government intervention and bailing out and socialism for the rich, there was vicious austerity for the rest of us. And all of this state intervention was important in terms of stabilising their system, but deep structural problems for the system remain. So there continues to be low investment in production, there continues to be speculative bubbles, chronic overproduction, and there are massive levels of debt in terms of corporate, state and private debt. So, for instance, in Italy, which is the fourth largest economy in Europe, they are said to hold a third of all non-performing loans. So that amounts to something like 20% of Italy's GDP. On top of that, there's low productivity in Italy, high rates of unemployment, youth unemployment is something like 40%. And then there's also an enormous amount of political turmoil in that country as well, with the election of a sort of far-right government of sorts. And so there's regular predictions that the Italian banks are just about to collapse. And, you know, if there was to be a real banking crisis in Italy, that would tear into German and French banks who are quite exposed. Okay, so there's the economic questions. There's also the questions of imperialism, sort of the crisis of US hegemony. So central to the volatility, I think, of the Western liberal capitalist order is the crisis of US power. The United States has been the superintendent of the neoliberal order, using international institutions like NATO, the World Bank, WTO, to pursue its imperial agenda and, you know, at the same time kind of manage the whole system. And a lot of countries sort of rely on the US as the global cop to keep the world safe for capitalism. The Trump's presidency is clearly hugely destabilizing, and Trump has, instead of utilising these institutions, has denounced NATO, has imposed tariffs on traditional allies like Canada and Germany, and threatened to place tariffs on Germany's key export, the car industry. He's also walked away from global agreements with, in terms of the Paris Climate Agreement. He's ripped up free trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership in favour of bilateral deals and moved to renegotiate NAFTA. And so I think that, you know, we've still talked about how there's a lot of continuity with Trump in terms of the Obama period, you know, and, you know, it's not this total break. On the other hand, I think that we should see that there's a sort of the accumulation of issues for the US have sort of created a bit of a qualitative difference under Trump. And there's a real thrashing about of the US ruling class trying to figure out how the fuck they can get out of the problems that they're in. And so, you know, while the US, I think, remains the most powerful nation in the world, you know, the big problem sort of for them is that their economic and military power is declining relative to their rivals. They're still the most powerful nation, but they have the emergence of peer competitors. So first, they've got big problems in the Middle East, obviously, which is one of the most strategic areas of the globe with its vast oil reserves. Here, the US has suffered enormous military setbacks. So there's the catastrophic overreach of the Bush period when, you know, the invasions and occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, the US got bogged down there and ultimately has had to withdraw most of its forces from Iraq, and it's, you know, just basically trying to hold on in Afghanistan. This has ripped apart the fabric of these societies, helping to lead to the rise of formations like ISIS with its nihilistic violence. But it's also allowed other powers like Russia to become increasingly assertive in the Middle East, especially in Syria. It's also allowed a whole host of regional players like Israel, Turkey, Saudi Arabia and Iran to pursue a more independent course of action. So rather than calling the shots, which is what it had been like for a whole period of decades, the US policy in the Middle East largely, I think, now consists of damage control. And above all else, the main sort of problems for US power the Middle East is key, but I think China is really central to the US's problems. China has grown as a major power, and I think it really is beginning to threaten US global hegemony. Their economy has nearly eclipsed the size of the US's, And their economic growth has also allowed it to build up political alliances and influence. So the Chinese state uses its state firms to invest in African mines, to build Sri Lankan ports and so on. And then there's the Belt and Road policy, which is about a massive infrastructure drive to draw sort of Central Asian countries closer into Chinese influence. So the growth of the Chinese economy has also allowed it to develop itself militarily. Not only is it a nuclear power, but it's also starting to build up an impressive navy and trying to stake claims to strategic islands of the South China Sea as part of challenging US domination over the sea lanes, which is where a whole lot of world trade happens. Part of the economic growth... you can see that this whole kind of interrelationship between economic growth and military growth as well is some of the actions of Trump, that the imposing of tariffs have not just been on steel but on high-tech firms that are about trying to limit the kind of transfer of development in the military sphere to allow China to make gains on that level. So Trump's presidency has obviously been enormously disruptive, at times wildly incoherent, but I think it's important for people trying to analyse the situation to see as it's one kind of response to the problems that the US US capitalism is facing, that it's facing imperial decline, and that, you know, Trump's slogan of Make America Great Again is part of a response to try and restore US influence and power. Okay, I want to turn now to looking at some of the questions of the political crisis of the system, because there have been many political ramifications of the crisis of neoliberalism. First, I think it's important to say that neoliberalism has been unpopular for a whole period of time. It's not just like recently that all of a sudden there's, you know, problems for the traditional parties. One of the kind of most symbolic moments of the rejection of neoliberalism by populations was the Zapatista uprising in 1994. And then also people cast their mind back to the turn of the century. There was the anti-globalisation, anti-capitalist movement where millions of people around the world, particularly in the West, took to the streets to protest against the gatherings of the rich and powerful. We had our own one in Melbourne in the year 2000 against the World Economic Forum. So there's been kind of... It's not like neoliberalism as it was ever popular, but I think that the crisis of the political... of neoliberalism is really sort of come to a head with the crash. So, you know, there's a whole period where before the crash, there's mounting problems. So the Social Democratic Parties have long commented on how they've been hollowing out, that their active membership has been in decline, their branch structures have been atrophying, they don't have all these activists anymore. So they're much more shells of their former self. So this is a process happening before the crash, but things have really, I think, come to a head and accelerated since 2008. In particular, the Social Democratic Parties have really been punished for their role in implementing austerity. And in some places, the Social Democratic Parties have basically collapsed. The classic case is Greece. PASOK, which had been sort of like their Labour Party, had been in and out of power, but had received, you know, over 40%, 45%, I think, in, you know, one of the elections not too long ago. Of the vote. And now they struggle just to enter parliament. I think they actually may not even formally exist anymore. In France, the Socialist Party's president, Hollande, obviously Macron, he had been receiving approval ratings of 4%, which is pretty incredible. And he took the hint not to run in the 2016 election. And, you know, obviously, like the figure that emerged was Macron, who tried to present himself as some anti-establishment, you know, outsider. And clearly, he'd been a former member of Hollande's government. So just Hollande stepping aside didn't stop the Socialist Party in France from being obliterated. They actually received 6% of the presidential vote. Trump's presidency, I think, though, is probably the most important example of the crisis of political representation affecting the neoliberal centre. So despite the backing of basically the entirety of the capitalist class, including figures of the Republican Party, Hillary Clinton, who sort of, you know, was the neoliberal poster person, was unable to defeat the bigoted tangerine billionaire, no matter what he did or said on the campaign trail. And it's not just I think now the turmoil of Clinton's defeat in the Democrats. It's also, you can see that there's a massive amount of turmoil within the other traditional party of American capitalism, the Republican Party, which has been the A-team for American capitalism for a period. So decades of racist dog whistling, whipping up nationalism to justify wars, blaming minorities for social inequalities, all of these, racist campaigning practiced by both sides of politics have really created, I think, a political dynamic that has started to escape their clutches. So first there was the Tea Party Rebellion, which was basically evangelical neoliberal nutters, and now there's Trump, and he's really driven the Republican base in a more hyper, nationalistic, xenophobic, misogynistic direction. And we can see this process happening in quite a number of centre-right parties around the world, where a sort of technocratic, I guess, bourgeois wing, the traditional political leaders of those parties are starting to be challenged by, an insurgent hard right, a really kind of fanatical, radicalised, racist wing that they've helped to cultivate, but now has a sort of dynamic of its own. We could see that, obviously, pretty clearly in Australia with the recent Liberal Party leadership spill. So overwhelmingly, the beneficiaries of the crisis of political representation has been the far right. Take Italy, the governing coalition in Italy is not one of the two major parties of Italian capitalism. Instead, it's two outsider parties. There's the Five Star Movement, led by a comedian, Beppe Grillo. It's kind of like a populist party, I guess, in the sense that it's not a far-right party. It talks about, the people versus the elite, and it's all about cleaning up the corruption of the political class. And it's in coalition with a far-right party called the League, which had formerly been called the Northern League. And this is a far-right party that's based on opposing immigrants, opposing the Roma, and so on. And it's really the politically dominant section of this coalition. And they've promised to have a registration for Roma. So this is something that the Nazis... Mussolini did was to say that Roma needs to be registered, promised to deport 500,000 migrants, refused to allow any refugee boats to dock at Italian ports and so on. They're making good on this promise. And Italy is not an exception at all. The xenophobia, racism and increasingly illiberal authoritarian measures shape politics in country after country. In Austria, which has largely been spared by the crisis, so we shouldn't just sort of see it as some kind of like, reduce it to an economic response if you have crisis in the far right. There, the Freedom Party, which has roots in the Nazi Party, are now in a power-sharing arrangement with conservatives. In France, Marine Le Pen of the National Front, fascist organisation, narrowly missed out on getting through the second round of the presidential elections. In fact, though, they got the highest vote out of all of the parties, but didn't... they were topping the polls for a whole period anyway. In Germany, Nazis have once again entered the Reichstag, an alternative for Deutschland, which is has kind of really radicalised. It kind of had been a neoliberal party, now it's starting to be to become much more of a clearer far-right party. In some polls, it actually even topped the Social Democratic Party, the SPD. And we just saw some incredibly disturbing scenes in Chemnitz, which is where the far-right thugs, so thousands of far-right thugs, many from Eastern Germany but also coming from across the country, descended on Chemnitz after a German was killed. And the accusers, people have said, are immigrants. And so fascists have been going rampaging across the streets of this city, attacking anyone that looks foreign, pogroms. The news of who was the attacker was, it seems, leaked by the police as well, so you can see the kind of intersection between the far right and the police. And the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, are really backing these protesters and saying it's clear that, the state can't protect people and therefore we need to have Nazis patrolling the streets. And that's what we're also seeing, images of Nazis in their their vests and so on, patrolling the streets of Chemnitz. Okay, so pretty frightening stuff. Now, before I continue, I do want to, though, make a few comments about the term populism, because the talk's obviously about has that word in its title. And I think that the term is bandied about a lot, and it's sort of used to try and just describe any manifestation of opposition to the status quo, whether it comes from the left or the right. And I think that it's important that we don't really just use the term willy-nilly, that it doesn't do very much to explain anything. And in fact, it can often be used to give legitimacy to the far right. So instead of calling formations for what they are, fascist or far right, Nazis, instead, oh, they're just populist, right-wing populist formations. So, you know, that they somehow express some legitimate concerns. Also, I think the term populism can be used by neoliberal commentators to delegitimise left-wing challenges to its agenda. So anything that's against neoliberalism or against Europe is called populist. So, you know, it's just it's equally invalid as the far right to be, you know, to oppose, for instance, the European Union. You're just connecting with the base desires of society. So, you know, populism is just sort of this slur. So there clearly are populist parties, and I think that Five Star in Italy is one, but I reckon that most often the term is used to mystify rather than explain the dynamics. Okay, so explaining the rise of the far right in Europe, I think we have to, it's going to be a whole session on that, but one thing is to really place the blame at the feet of the extreme centre of traditional parties, that the neoliberal centre has broken lives across the world, you know, with its policies impoverishing people, destroying organisations of, you know, defence of the working class and so on. They've also, the extreme centre, because it has an unpopular programme, nothing to offer ordinary people, has turned themselves to adopting racist and nationalist themes to distract from these unpopular programmes, and that's helped to feed the far right and to give legitimacy to their politics. So they've helped to sort of plough the ground for the rise of the far right. The dynamic is also sort of working the other way, that the strength then of the far right helps to pull the political situation further to the right. And you can see that the far right's ideas extend beyond its sort of electorate as well. So, you know, the impact of the far right is really clear in the case of, I think, the new government in Italy, that they've been able to drive immigration policy further to the right in terms of, you know, Angela Merkel, now they've thrown up and resurrected internal borders within Europe as part of, yeah, capitulating to the impact of the far right. Anyway. Yes, so I wanted to say a few words about Australia and to look at where Australia fits into the picture, because at times it can obviously seem pretty dull here, that we're kind of immune and buffeted from, we're not part of you know, all of the turmoil happening in the rest of the world. But I think that it is important that there are similar to see that there are similar dynamics at play here as well. But some of the things that are different in Australia are obviously the economic situation, that unlike the rest of the world, Australia has experienced decades of uninterrupted economic growth. And in terms of the economic growth, overwhelmingly, the fruits of that have gone to the top of society, you know, overwhelmingly, it's the rich and powerful who are benefiting. Major growth in inequality in Australia. But there was a whole period where, during this sort of period of growth, that wages were increasing, and like in real terms, and that helped to underpin a certain stability in the Australian political situation. That it wasn't the case that there's this red hot anger and everyone's just desperately struggling to survive. There definitely were key pockets, like huge pockets of inequality and poverty. So, for instance, in Broadmeadows, in one of the suburbs in Melbourne, has 25% unemployment. But for a lot of the working class, there had been a period of living conditions improving, even if there was a tax on the right to organise, privatisation, user pays, all that kind of stuff. So the neoliberal medicine was being implemented. But yeah, I think kind of when people think, why was there a whole period of disconnection and stability, that the economic questions, I think, are part of the picture. But, you know, the economy is still sluggish, and per capita it's not that great if you look at it in terms of growth on that basis. And now we are seeing actually wages stagnate in Australia. For some people's wages are barely keeping up with inflation, others' wages have gone backwards. And there's also clearly widespread anxiety about the rising cost of living, the rising cost of electricity, of housing, and so on, which is clearly outstripping wage growth. So I think that we're kind of entering now a bit of a different period, and we'll see what kind of impact it has on the political situation here. But clearly, even before that, neoliberalism has been unpopular in Australia, that there isn't widespread support for privatisation. People generally support a more sort of social democratic program of there should be funding for health and education. Those things shouldn't be privatised. But often the way that so the discontent with the situation in Australia expresses itself, instead of major polarisation, has been more a disengagement with politics, a cynicism about politics, a sense that the politicians all lie, the media lies, it's all bullshit, politics is rubbish. You know, so I'm just going to disengage and just focus on trying to get on with my life. One of the things that reinforces, I think, the withdrawal from politics is the approach of the trade unions in Australia, the leadership, who have overwhelmingly been obsessed not with trying to organise at the base, encourage people to take a stand, to make an argument that your activity can transform society. Instead, have been really focused on getting the vote out for the Labor Party rather than rebuilding on the shop floor. And I think that actually it's important to understand the Change the Rules campaign in that kind of light, that involves some mobilisation of people, some argument to society that, you know, the power imbalance has gone too far, the workers are having a raw deal. That mainly it was about an elaborate attempt to lay the basis for marginal seats campaigning, to go out and do door knocking in marginal suburbs to help electorates, to help the Labor Party get elected. And, you know, that does nothing, obviously, to pierce people's cynicism and just and general disengagement. But, yeah, I think that there is... I think it is important for people not to think that, you know, when we've sort of seen Dutton, you know, the rise of Hanson, the people just think that in Australia there's everything's going to the right. I don't think that's the case. And, you know, well, one thing you can see in terms of is that there isn't that kind of polarisation collapse of the Social Democratic Party. So the Labor Party's got 41% of the primary vote at the moment. Also, they're making a bit of a tilt to some extent in terms of rhetorically around saying that, you know, Bill Shorten is for health and education and things like that. And that's because he's trying to connect with an actual sentiment that exists out there amongst broad mass of people that, you know, and that neoliberalism's ideological case wasn't really won here. But people can see that there's a real shallowness to that. The Bill Shorten is no Corbyn. He's not about to tear anything, you know, transform anything, shake the system up. But it's all pretty cynical. Yeah, so if we sort of look at the question of the Liberal Party, clearly a lot of turmoil there, and a lot of the kind of those questions of polarisation, volatility is happening in that party. They've been clearly hurt by the 2014 budget to begin with, you know, the sort of overreach there, the massive attacks that they were waging on people, that there was a real reaction to that, which kind of limited its capacity to deliver for the ruling class, to have more confident attacks on working class people. But you can see that, yeah, the crisis in terms of the development of a hard right within the party, a section that doesn't really care whether it's got much purchase with the rest of the population, but, you know, is this sort of frenzied racist, we want to, like, basically import the sort of Trumpist style of politics into the party, because actually there's a base for that in terms of the Liberal Party membership. And so, yeah, we're seeing the kind of the fact that Turnbull, despite the fact that he tried to play by the hard right playbook of Islamophobia, bashing unions, keeping refugees tortured in detention camps, you know, he wasn't able to hold off really that insurgent hard right, who then, you know, a lot of people kind of heaving a sigh of relief that we've got Morrison instead of Dutton, who's basically a fascist. But Morrison is basically cut from the same cloth as Dutton. He is no moderate. So despite all the turmoil that has happened at the top, you know, in terms of leadership changes, I think that one thing about Australia is that the bosses have gotten on with the class war here, and, you know, they've been ripping up enterprise bargaining agreements, the agreement that workers have in their workplaces, so undermining conditions, holding down wages and so on. Also, the lurch to the right in terms of Liberal Party hasn't stopped the growth of the far right here in Australia either, even if they aren't the kind of main dynamic of what's happening. Then nonetheless, they are growing. And so, you know, we see Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party get 16%, I think, support in the polls recently in Longman, and she was even polling higher. we've also seen a whole gamut of far-right crazies come and descend on Australia from the international basements of the far right. So we've got Lauren Southern and John Molyneux. We've had Milo. Milo's coming back and so on. There's a reason why Australia's become a mecca for these far-right people to tour, and that's because they think there is actually a growing audience for them. There's an ability for them to make money. So they might be a fringe and a minority, but they're a growing fringe. And I think that kind of those dynamics of the rise of the far-right, the polarisation, some of that is starting to really impact on Australia. And I think really one of the key things that's holding back the far right in Australia is that they haven't had a stable organisational framework in which to operate in. You know, that Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party, it's not a home for all of the far right to be able to go and organise in. It's so very idiosyncratic and it's, constantly throwing up, totally inept candidates that end up, it all ends up exploding. And so I think that's one of the things that have really held them back. Whereas in other countries, like in France, you've got a very established and rooted far-right party, the National Front, and that, I think, obviously aids them. So we just sort of finished by having a look at the left, because clearly the crisis of the system, the crisis of political representation, that doesn't automatically lead to a progressive outcome. So we've gone through how actually it's the far-right that are the main beneficiaries at the moment. Everywhere, the left, I think, is pretty weak and disorganised and faces a lot of challenges, but there are obviously some opportunities as well. While it's not the norm, there have been left-wing breaks. So in Greece, there was the spectacular rise of Syriza in 2012, and, they ultimately capitulated, but that rise nonetheless happened. There's Corbyn's left-wing leadership of the Labour Party, which has inspired hundreds of thousands of people to join the Labour Party. Again, Corbyn's sort of faltering positions, his refusal to stand up to the accusations of that he's anti-Semitic for supporting the Palestinians. A lot of the sort of, he's now kind of like seeing himself as a government in waiting, and so has really stopped that kind of left-wing insurgent kind of campaigning. And I think that that's sort of, again, limiting the political situation in the UK. We've had the rise of Bernie Sanders' challenge to the establishment Democrats. And again, there we see both positives, expression of the discontent, people desiring a more progressive response to the crisis. But then the political strategy of Bernie Sanders is very much to channel that discontent back into one of the main vehicles of American capitalism, the Democrats, to entrap it within it, to breathe life back into this decrepit institution. One of the other things I think that's been a real sort of weakness of the situation is that a lot of the breaks to the left have been overwhelmingly political. So that's something that, there's been electoral kind of challenges that have arisen. But it hasn't been backed up with a rise of industrial or social movement struggle. Generally, in the case of Greece, the rise of Syriza accompanied the decline of struggle on the streets. It's part of a response to say, well, we can't stop austerity with our general strikes. Maybe if we get a left government, that will help. But that obviously then means that there's no pressure on these parties to be held to account to actually deliver in confronting the Troika and the powers that be to move forward with austerity. So I think this points to a few things for the left. In terms of rebuilding, there's all these challenges and difficulties, but politics is absolutely key. Well, on what political basis are you building? Is this, is the left-wing response about ultimately reinforcing institutions that want to manage capitalism? Or are you trying to build a politics that's saying what we need is something independent? We need an independent break from the major parties. What we need is a politics that puts the working class at the centre of our politics, their interests, their needs, and doesn't say, oh, what about the health of the national economy? Maybe workers need to make sacrifices. And that's just how it has to be. Fuck their profits. We say, no, actually, it's workers' interests that have to be front and centre, no compromises on that. Putting forward a clear class alternative. The other thing is about resisting. That can't just be enough to break, though, the far right. You can say, well, in a lot of the far right's rise is about the discontent with the policies of the neoliberal centre, and we just put a class program that will weaken them. That's not enough. We actually also have to confront the politics of the far right as well. We have to confront racism. We have to build movements that are about uniting people to challenge the anti-immigrant sentiment, to challenge anti-Roma sentiment, anti-Muslim sentiment, and so on. So there's a lot of things that need to happen. And, you know, it can seem, I think, a very, very daunting situation because of the state of the left. But it has to, our rebuilding has to start somewhere. And, you know, meetings like this about trying to politically clarify our ideas are very important because, you know, when people talk about resistance, we need to see collective action on the streets. We also need to see politics that's clear to help fuel that resistance so it doesn't end in the disasters, you know, like Bernie Sanders endorsing Clinton and everyone being disoriented and demoralised by that, or, you know, Syriza's capitulation and so on. Yeah, and I think that it is urgent that we don't just throw up our hands in despair and say that there's nothing that we can do. We should just get on with our lives. And I think that, you know, when you see the emergence of things like the teacher strikes in the US that we'll be talking about tomorrow, that the possibilities for resistance, that discontent, that bubbling away underneath the surface, that it can explode in ways that you just don't think will happen. This is in West Virginia and Arizona, a whole lot of these places are places that elected Trump, that were Trump-majority states. And yet, there's all these contradictions to that. There's a lot of people who, were just trying to strike a blow at, which was wrong, to strike a blow, at the establishment by supporting Trump. We support not voting for either Democrats or the Republicans. And yet, in this place, the sort of pressures that, had been building up, but also individuals who are socialists, who are radicals, people with experiences, trade unions, have been arguing, trying to say we've got to push back, and it started to connect up with people. And you see the snowballing and the wave of teacher strikes that have happened across the states, which are really inspiring. And, it shows the possibilities that workers, even when they've, been ground down so much, also the possibilities for resistance are still there, and that's something that we should hold dear.